The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. My name is Mark Niles. I am Associate Dean for Academic Affairs here at the Washington College of Law, and I'm one more person who is here to welcome you all to our institution. My colleague Munir Ahmed on the first day mentioned made reference to some of the benefits of having a person of color as your dean and all the wonderful ways in which it helps our lives and all the things that it brings to us. And one of the benefits, or thing I look at it, drawbacks, is there are many people of color in leadership positions in this institution. And those of us who have taken on those positions certainly see it as a benefit, but also as a drawback every now and then. But usually we feel very good about it. Most of our high-level staff positions are manned and womaned by people of color. And now one of the two academic deans for associate deans for academic affairs is me. And so it's a wonderful place. We have a great faculty representation of people of color, African Americans, Latinos, and Asians on our faculty, and we're very happy with the presence we have of a wide diversity of people, both faculty and students and staff. So welcome again from my perspective and from the law school. I'm also here to introduce our lunch speaker, who's Tanya Banks. Tanya has asked me not to go on and on about all the wonderful things about her, which I could do for about an hour, but I'm going to let her talk instead. I will say instead that I met Tanya early in my career as a law professor, and she's been a wonderful role model and example to me, both sort of generally and specifically. Generally, it's been true, I think, for my group of, or for my era of faculty members who have come into law school as teachers. We benefited from people who came in 5, 10 years before us in the same way that various people in different institutions, people of color, have benefited from people who came before them. The success and the wonderful things that colleagues of color have had in this institution for years before I even got started made it possible for me and the other people who are entering into academia now to do what we've done, and certainly Tanya is a wonderful example of that. So she's paved the way for many of us in various ways, and I'm not talking 20 years ago, but paved the way in a way that has been very beneficial to all of us. I didn't want to say, leave that up to her. But it's meant a lot to all of us to have that kind of both example for what we can strive for, but also a track record of people who have been successful to make it possible for us to be treated with respect and be treated seriously in the work that we've done, so we all benefit from that. More specifically, Tanya works in a field that I also work in, which is law and culture, specifically law and film, as Tanya is one of her great focuses, and she's really one of the top people in the country dealing with this issue, both in terms of her writing and her curricular activities. And she is doing a symposium on law and film this spring in Baltimore, which is a wonderful event with national recognition and wonderful people coming from around the country. We're also on a panel together at Law and Society in Baltimore in April. So I've had a wonderful chance to learn from her in this field also. And it's a emerging field, but it's the kind of thing as a junior faculty member that it was wonderful to see important and very successful people working in this field that give me the sense that something that I wanted to do and felt like I could do well in, that there was, again, someone sort of paving a trail in a way that made it possible for me to do what I've done. So in so many ways, Tanya is the greatest example for me of what a law professor should be. So I'm very honored to welcome you all, but also to introduce Tanya as our lunch speaker today. Tanya.
Okay, Mark. All right. Thank you. That's okay. And just so that people will know, although I think you'll know when I start this introduction, starting in September will be my 30th year in law teaching. Okay. So. First of all, I must admit, when I got the email from Dorothy inviting me to speak, I was absolutely shocked and thrilled. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm an old timer. I've been around. A lot of people in this audience have heard me a lot. And I mean, but I was also thrilled because it meant that Dorothy thought that I had something worthwhile to say. And you know, as you get older, you normally sort of keep, you know, redoing stuff that you've done before. And so I'm going to use this time that I have here as an opportunity to be provocative. And what I'm going to do is pretty much stick to the script, because you know, those of you who know me know that I tend to deviate. but I'm trying to get through this sort of in a structured way. A little more than 6 years ago, I described a forthcoming article of mine to another academic of color. In that article, I questioned whether contemporary race-based anti-discrimination laws and theories are adequate to handle discrimination based upon skin tone, colorism, against people who are raised as black in America. To my surprise, the academic responded in alarm, "Why, you're destabilizing blackness." And I said, "Yes. What is wrong with that if the end product is a more accurate way of addressing racial inequality in the United States?" Unpersuaded, this academic thought I was a race traitor. Over the years, I thought a lot about that conversation and how to address continuing and more nuanced race discrimination and inequality in the 21st century. Last year, this is another disclosure, I entered my 60th year on this earth. In fact, Super Bowl Sunday will be my 61st year. And making provocative comments, I believe, is a prerogative of getting older. You know, my friend and schoolmate, Paulette Caldwell, sent me many years ago before I turned 50, this wonderful piece that appeared in the New York Times about women coming into their own when they hit 50. And I think it's really true. I think my writing has gotten better. And I feel better, you know. So, I mean, there is a future beyond 40, folks. So, my talk today is intended to provoke. I start with four short stories about blackness in contemporary America. And, you know, and I always try and not, you know, sort of talk only about blackness. But what I say today is a message intended not only for people who are concerned about racial justice for people raised as black, but I think the project that I am throwing out here to all of you is something that I think can be embraced by all people who write about and think about racial subordination in the United States. But anyway, my story is about blackness because for reasons that will become clear. These stories, I contend, support my claim that we need to develop theories of black racial pluralism that can be added to the box of tools we use to dismantle deeply entrenched notions of white racial superiority in America and in the world. And I will leave it to you to decide whether I'm a race traitor or whether I'm on to something helpful. My first story. Less than 6 months after the United States Supreme Court decided that state colleges and universities could use race as a factor when making admissions decisions, Harvard professors Lonnie Guinier and Henry Louis Gates appeared on the front page of the New York Times, opining about the absence of American-born descendants of African slaves at Harvard University. According to the article, a disproportionate number of black Americans at Harvard are Afro-Caribbean, who are either born outside the U.S. or are the children of recent immigrants from Caribbean countries. Early in 2005, a front page article in the New York Times proclaimed, and I quote, "More Africans enter U.S. than in days of slavery," end quote. Although the number of migrants from African countries is nowhere near as great as the number of migrants from Latin America and Asian countries, the point of the Times article was that the increased presence of blacks from African countries, the Caribbean, and Latin America challenges the largely monolithic way white Americans, and I should say black Americans, view blacks, and raises concerns that the descendants of American slaves will be left behind. My second story, I have a comment after the end of the second story, is a related story. Illinois U.S. Senator Barack Obama, while still a candidate, won rave reviews for his keynote address at the 2004 Democratic National Convention. Obama, a Harvard Law School graduate, is the son of a Kenyan father, also a Harvard graduate, and a white Iowan mother. He admits that he was a beneficiary of affirmative action, and somewhat ironically falls into that category of affirmative action beneficiaries about whom Lonnie Guinier and Gates raised concerns. Obama was raised in Hawaii, where he lived with his white grandparents. Perhaps because of his background, not all members of that community raced as black in the United States, gave him the same level of laudatory praise generated by Jesse Jackson's keynote address at the 1984 Democratic National Convention. Instead, Obama's presence at the convention was met with suspicion by many black American descendants of slaves who wondered whether he was really black. I mean, I had this conversation with the guy who cuts my hair. They said, he's not really black. And these same people questioned whether Obama should have been a beneficiary of affirmative action designed to remedy discrimination against the descendants of American slaves. Now, these first two stories illustrate how current affirmative action or diversity theories tend to pit the Obamas of America against the descendants of American slaves, like my children, my grandchildren, if I ever have any. Their father and I are like sort of working on that. We may need to draw distinctions between affirmative action designed to remediate or repair the damage wrought by slavery, de jure, race-based segregation, and their legacies, and the need in an increasingly heterogeneous society for diversity within professions and in colleges and universities. My third story, I'm not through with that, but I'm going to go to the third story. My third story is the mirror image of the second story. In 1993, President William Clinton nominated Mario Bezerra. Thank you, Wilkins. I forgot to ask you that on the way down. Baeza, okay. A prominent lawyer at Du Bois in Clifton to be Assistant Secretary for Inter-American Affairs. The nomination of Bezerra, an Afro-Cuban, was scuttled by anti-Castro Cuban-American groups, overwhelmingly led by, I put this in quotes, white Cubans, because I don't think this is such a thing as white Cubans, but they call themselves white Cubans. Their opposition, some claim, was because Bezerra favored trade with Cuba, but others suggested that Bezerra's race was another factor. A few suggested that he identified with black Americans, not Cuban Americans, so he really was not Cuban, despite the fact that he was born in Cuba. People raced as black in America are members of multiple communities. We have multiple identities that sometimes intersect, overlap, sometimes even conflict, in ways not anticipated by a monoracial approach to discrimination. Consider the racialized gender dynamics raised by the confrontation between Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. For the sake of racial solidarity, some black Americans felt Hill should have remained silent about being sexually harassed by Thomas. The reaction of the black community to the Hill-Thomas affair illustrated the male dominance of the black race narrative. Thomas's invocation of the lynching trope trumped Hill's sexual allegations. Because her assailant was not white, her invocation of the black female sex trope did not fit the black race narrative. And sexuality in the black community? Unmentionable, non-existent, even though we know better. The monoracial approach also results in the conflation of class and race, and a liberal racial dialogue that uncritically pushes for class-based remedies that may not ultimately result in racial and social justice. There's no time to develop these points or to give further illustrations, because I could talk, for example, about black people who are included in what Richard Florida characterizes the new creator class, or who Anthony Appiah called cosmopolitans. But, I mean, that's a whole another story. Because I want to end my last story with what is sort of the classic story of black racism in the United States. What's the name of that New York City, Cheryl and Oni? I always say
Oneonta.
Okay. My final story is the classic story of black racism. Thank God for my colleague. My final story is the classic story of black racism in the United States. In 1992, Oneonta, New York, set out to locate and question, I'm sure some of you have heard, every black man in town after a white woman reported being robbed in her home by a young black man. Over a period of several days, police stopped and questioned more than 200 non-white persons on the street, inspecting their hands for cuts. The police practice, challenged unsuccessfully, is a variation of the common police practice nicknamed driving while black that targets black motorists. studies suggest that Black Americans are disproportionately and systematically stopped by police officers while traveling on the highway. The race of the person detained by the police is frequently the only basis for the action. But even in this situation, only Blacks who do not look white are adversely affected. Blacks who are phenotypically indistinguishable from whites, and there are some, we know some, do not experience this form of race discrimination. Okay, so what is this all about? These stories about the different experiences of Black people in America cause me to wonder whether there is a unitary Black experience in 21st century America. We tend to forget or ignore the reality of Black identity in America. Black identity is an amalgamation of cultures from distinct African, European origins, as well as from more contemporary Afro-Caribbean, African, and Afro-Latino cultures. Black identity today, and probably always, is pluralized. Scholars like Tommy Shelby and Zipporah Glass argue that, and I'm quoting here from Zipporah Glass, mestizaje has always been a part of Blackness in the United States, but it was suppressed to make Blackness the primary organizing principle to fight de jure segregation. But today, important shifts in the composition of the U.S. population and contemporary constructions and representations of biological, that's my phone and that's my son, cultural mixes. It was not my son, it was Kim's colleague. my former colleague, but she's known me like since I was 20, so she knows I'm crazy. Let me start with that last sentence here. Today, important shifts in the composition of the U.S. population and contemporary constructions and representations of biological and cultural mixtures problematize the very nature of Black identity and the Black experience in America. And I think that was what Cedric was talking about yesterday after the last panel. Yet the rhetoric of the so-called Black community, and I call it the so-called Black community, because I'm always asking people in Baltimore when they say the Black community, I'm saying, so like, which Black community? You're talking about the Black community that was here during slavery? You're talking about the Nigerian community that lives over here? You're talking about the Afro-Caribbean community that lives over here? Who are you talking about? And they go like, But with this rhetoric of the so-called Black community assumes a homogeneous Black people who share a common identity and history in America. Yet the varieties of ways Black in America experience race-based discrimination and race-related discrimination, and the extent to which factors like ancestry, gender, geography, sexuality, and socioeconomic class influence how discrimination is manifest makes it increasingly difficult to adopt a mono-racial approach to anti-Black discrimination in contemporary America. For example, and this is one of my favorite ones, the legal definition of the racial category Black is firmly grounded in this notion of hypo descent. I have written about that until I am tired. I am weary. Any remote African ancestry makes one indistinguishably Black and blinds the courts to racial meanings conveyed by ethnicity or skin color. Even in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when the U.S. Census used terms like mulatto and quadroon, these categories were treated as subsets of the Negro category. What resulted was a racialized group expansive enough to include people who looked indistinguishable from other whites and that forged a particular group identity. A politicized racial solidarity developed among people raised as Black in America as an important tool in securing the end of de jure race-based segregation. But a byproduct of this politicized racial solidarity is what public intellectual Cornel West characterizes as racial reasoning, where race becomes the surrogate for more reliable predictors of performance, I'm invoking Clarence Thomas here, like qualifications or beliefs. Well, science is an example, of course, of the negative consequences of racial reasoning. The focus of discussions about the nomination and subsequent confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Pressure to retain racial solidarity for perceived political advantage means that subsets of race-related discrimination, like colorism, which result in multiple forms of discrimination, get overlooked or ignored. For example, my popular culture reference. Recently, Aaron Magruder, creator of Boondocks, the comic strip, and now television series, which is a whole nother thing, drafted a strip that ran where the first panel showed Huey Friedman, if you aren't a Boondocks person, he's the militant kid in the family, telling Jasmine Dubois, and if you don't know who she is, that's his biracial friend and neighbor who has identity issues. that Mary J. Blige said, quote, "In America, the blacker you are, the worse it is for you. But if you're mixed, you've got a shot." And Jasmine responds, "Sweet." The second panel shows Huey looking at Jasmine. And if you've ever seen Huey look at anybody who thinks it's crazy, you know what that looked like, okay? And the third panel is Huey walking away and Jasmine explaining, "What? She didn't get it, just like most Americans." Legal scholars are reluctant to address race discrimination based on a variety of factors, like skin tone, for fear of disrupting black political solidarity. But if we don't, discrimination and the resulting injustice will not disappear or significantly diminish, because it's certainly not going to disappear in my lifetime or my children's lifetime or my grandchildren's lifetime, assuming I have any. Further, 20th century civil rights legislation reinforces effective and antiquated notions of black monoracialism and black political solidarity. Monoracial and ethnic classifications were reinforced in 1978 when the U.S. Office of Management and Budget standardized collection of racial data by the U.S. Bureau of Census and all other government agencies. Why? To determine compliance with contemporary anti-discrimination laws. One byproduct, however, is that the politicized racial solidarity as a result of, you know, both our success in the past and the need to keep the numbers up for compliance purposes results in a policing of race from within. We're always like, Mariah Carey's really black, you know. Tiger Woods. I don't care whether he calls himself. He's really black, you know. And although we're less sure about Michael Jackson. The resistance and ongoing debate within the legal community about the use of multiracial categories on the U.S. Census is an example of this phenomenon. And the primary opponents of multiracial categories are black political leaders who invoke varying strains of traditional black racial solidarity. As Magruder's comic strip suggests, the maintenance of a monoracial legal category, black or African-American, that includes all people with any African ancestry results in an identity crisis for many, especially people who are openly mixed race, Afro-Latinos, Afro-Caribbean, and I would say Africans. I mean, I picked up Crisis Magazine yesterday, just the new issue of Crisis Magazine just came in. Front page is a very good article. It's a cover article about the impact of black immigrants coming into the United States. And it raises some of the points I think that Cedric was trying to get to yesterday about people from Eritrea saying, you know, I'm Eritrean. I'm not, you know, black. I don't view this as blackness. And it raises some really, it creates, you know, legal quandaries as well. And here's my real life example. John Turns Rosenthal in an article entitled Batson Revisited in America uses this case, United States versus White, to illustrate how racial hybridity impacts on jury selection and potential relief for exclusion of blacks from the jury. He recounts, and this is true, how the judge during the voir dire process asked potential jurors whether they could be fair and impartial given the defendant was a black male. The record reflects that the judge observed that only one potential juror appeared to be an African American. But at that point, another juror stated that she wanted the judge to know that she was an African American. The judge thanked her for her candor and stated that he would not have recognized her as an African American. And he believed that not many others would have recognized her as being African American. And guess what the prosecutor did? Nope, dismissed only the visibly black juror. Batson challenges are difficult enough as it is under a monoracial approach, but they become even more problematic when multiracial individuals are involved. What should we do in these situations? Has black political solidarity become an anachronism? Thank you. Philosophy scholar Tommy Shelby, in his book, We Who Are Dark, The Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity, which just came out and I recommend to all of you, asked whether black political solidarity leads to a more just society and world, and if so, what form must it take to produce this result? And this is essentially my question placed in a legal context, a legal theory context. Like Shelby, I am not arguing for the end of black solidarity, black political solidarity, even black legal theory solidarity. Only a more efficient reformulation designed for the world we find ourselves in at the beginning of the 21st century. Shelby writes that he seeks to identify a basis for black political unity that does not deny, downplay, or disparage individual or group differentiation within the black population. Likewise, I urge you to join me in developing legal anti-racist theories that do not deny, downplay, or disparage individual or group differences within the groups raced as black or non-white. Shelby also writes that the key to creating and maintaining meaningful and effective black political unity is to highlight and distinguish between the various forms of unfair social disadvantage that blacks, and I would say other non-whites, face in this country. This approach, he argues, shifts the focus away from questions of racial identity toward the various dimensions of racial justice. We are still focused on who is black. While I do not agree with all the things that Shelby says in his book, I think his fundamental idea about highlighting and distinguishing differences between racist conduct and practices that impact on people of color is a useful project. And as things now, contemporary race legal theory is problematic and will not clearly lead us to a more socially just world. I'm hoping that some of the things that I'm throwing out here today will be picked up by you, some of you, and you know, you will take these home, chew on them, and start thinking about new theories. More than a decade ago, Berkeley Ethnic Studies professor Michael Almy argued that members within a racially subordinated group may be differently racialized. And at the end of the last century, I wrote in my colorism article, just as critical white studies scholars write that there are degrees of whiteness, there are also degrees of blackness. Race-based discrimination is experienced differently within racialized groups because of customs, cultures, biases, and even different histories. Race in America manifests itself at multiple levels within and between racialized groups. As a result, we need new theories to attack these multiple levels of race-based, race-related discrimination. Thank you.
Well, I mean, there's a piece that I did at a conference in Berkeley that
It's going to be part of a book on colorism in America in the 21st century. And I talk about the fact, I mean, one of the, and actually you were the one who pointed this, the CNN point to me, that the image, and I mean, and if I was going to do my slideshow, I have the image from the New York Times showing these people huddled together, or people huddled together, and in Berkeley, I held this up and I said, this looks like any refugee from some African country that we've seen over the years, and yet this is occurring in America. And then I have the video from Wolf Blitzer, in which he is talking about, he is totally distressed in seeing the pictures. And he goes, all these people, and they are so poor and so black. And so the image shot around the world of black Americans, despite Condoleezza Rice, despite Colin Powell, is of poor people, black people, helpless, infirm, criminals, drug addicts, all the false rumors. That's the global image. And it is reinforced, that's giving you the popular cultural reference, by some of the rap music and the rap videos. I mean, I was in May in a small fishing village in Turkey in the mountains, probably the first black person they've ever seen. The kids who could speak English, because they're learning it in junior high school, come up to me and they say, "American, we love MTV. They know the raps. They think that because I'm an American, I'm going to be they wanted to know what the latest songs were." Okay. I'm in Ghana.
You said
Etta James. I mean, it took me a second. You know, I'm singing Farrah Jacka. I'm saying even my kids who are in their 30s don't know the latest songs. I mean, they listen to public radio just like I do. But that was their image of an American. I mean, a black American. I mean, I go to Ghana. And you go and you see MTV, well, anywhere in the world, you go and see MTV International, and, we're there, and it's bitches and hoes, and, I mean, it's so anti-male. Even Queen Latifah and LL Cool J were talking about how much more vicious, rap has gotten. But that image, all the American TV that gets blasted everywhere. I mean, they love Judge Judy, but they also watch Law and Order, too. Mm-hmm. And so, I was in South Africa, and I was telling Sherilyn that the thing I could understand, I've been in South Africa before, people never had any problem identifying me as American because of my flat American accent. As he said, this time, the whole time I was there, they kept saying, "Oh, you have a British accent." And I was like, "I don't have a British accent." But Sherilyn said, and I think this has this shows the power of the visual image. I don't look like what people now think of as an American. As a black American, yeah. And so that doesn't mean that I don't experience, what Philomena Assad calls everyday racism. You go in the store, you get that look of the person that's following you around. But it means that, because of class and education, it is like, Tanya Nennis and I write about, how we're moving toward a more Latin American notion of race. And how the more fluent you are, and the less black you look, and black now is the profuna model of blackness, the harder your life is in America. And the law doesn't get to it. Even though there are these nice few cases where the court acknowledges the existence of a Title VII claim for colorism, I have yet to see a case where it's been successfully done, except in the context of housing for Latinos.
I think this is building on the last thread, Black American versus blackness, and wondering if how this conversation fits into notions of Pan-Africanism. It seems that there is some degree of conflation between race and statehood or nationhood. Like, your example, I'm not black, I'm Eritrean. I mean, but that's a country, and black is a race. And so I'm wondering if there was a notion of blackness a separate from American, of being an American.
People don't think of themselves as black basically until they come here. I mean, I have one of my students is from, as Afro-Caribbean, and she said that when her family decided to move here, she was told by her teachers that she would be considered black. You know, she's a brown-skinned girl, that she would be considered black and not, you know, from the island that she's from. And so I think that's part, and in fact, one of the things that's so nice about the really well-done article in Crisis is, you know, it talks about the dialogue that people, that's why I always use the term race is black. I mean, this is an identity that's imposed on many people involuntarily, and it's different from the identity that those of us who are the descendants of American slaves and may have, and not all of us were descendants of American slaves. It may depend on what other mixture we may claim or we may want to claim. And I mean, I keep thinking about those parts of us, and most of us in here, plus I mean 75% of people who are raised as black and are the descendants are black in something else, have denied the rest of who we are. I mean, we have all of these identities. And why should we be forced into this thing that says, you aren't authentic unless you eat collards and chitlins or something like that? I mean, but at the same time, we can't deny that there are times when the law will treat all of us the same, and they don't care whether you're from Nigeria or, you know, Puerto Rico or Alabama or New York. But the way the law is, and the way we even talk about it, we don't create those spaces. And the people who get hurt are not us sitting in this room. They're the Katrina people. And until we unlink all of that, and we start not being unafraid to do it. I mean, Christy Cunningham's piece, and I don't see Christy in here today, is a really interesting piece where she sort of talks about, you know, is blackness really an identity? Do we need to move away from that? And that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying we sort of invoke the black community so uncritically. There is a need for black solidarity, but it has to be more pluralistic.
I just wanted to get your thoughts, kind of continuing on that with the affirmative action question that Professor Cornier raised. Do you feel like there should be kind of more of a bifurcation of what is meant by the black community to make sure that in her thinking, affirmative action, the benefits of affirmative action are, you know, at least significantly the descendants of slaves here in America? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I see where Lonnie is going, but can I say that Lonnie is me? I mean, I found it very interesting that she was making that comment, especially said she was a beneficiary of affirmative action. She who is both biracial and her father is Afro-Caribbean. But you get me wrong there. I think the world is big enough for all of that. I don't think we need to be pitting the Lonnie Guineers and the Barack Obamas against, you know, my kids or my grandchildren, because I think that Harvard can benefit just as much from having my grandchildren there and benefit even more by seeing diverse people who this country considers black. Because we aren't all the same. We have never been the same. This unity we have is a false unity. It was useful during de jure segregation because we were all impacted on it. I mean, this is why, you know, in the 60s, when the African, when various countries, when Ghana and other countries were liberated, the only way African dignitaries could travel before the passage of the 61st Civil Rights Act between D.C. and Delaware and be served was to be in their native dress. And there's this famous story about some newspaper reporters who worked for the Afro in Baltimore who decided that they were going to try it out. And they went around, I mean, their pictures dressed and were served. okay? And this was and this goes back to, if you read Dirk's, interest conversion theory, this is because, this is part of they're trying to fight communism. We didn't want Africa to go the way of the communists, so we were going to treat people from Africa differently, and it's the same thing. Let's talk about South Africa. You go to South Africa as an American, you do get treated differently, certainly in the old days. In fact, you could come in under the white category. When Richard Wright in the 50s went there, he didn't have to go through the colored thing. He got an honorary white card. And so, but we have to talk about these differences. We have to figure out a theory, theories that acknowledge all these differences, that force courts to look at these differences. I've been working on colorism, because I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my goodness, when I grew up there, it still is a problem. It was a serious problem when I grew up. And so it's an issue close to my heart. But there's so many other variations of this. And colorism should be an easy thing, and yet it's so hard. Yes?
I just wanted to ask, how do we respect all of the different diasporic elements that we bring, especially just here in America, living here, when there are differences amongst the communities, but there are, as you pointed out, still times when we are treated exactly the same? And I guess I'm thinking specifically of Amadou Diallo. They didn't stop to ask, him, his nation of origin or anything like that. They just, as you would say, if he was raised as black and that's all that they needed to make the decisions that they made. So how do we not be uncritical about our solidarity and get behind somebody like a Clarence Thomas or a Michael Jackson, whatever celebrity happens to be on trial, but yet and still, when there's a need for solidarity, we can still say that, how do we kind of navigate that space?
But this is what Shelby's writing about. That's what I'm saying. I suggest that you read this book. He's talking about reformulating a more effective and viable notion of black political solidarity that doesn't sort of require or assume that we're all the same, but that recognizes that this is a very heterogeneous community, that we have different issues and problems, and there are times when we can all get together, but that our overall goal will always be the same, namely the elimination of discrimination based upon race or race-like categories. And we'll always need an all-purpose anti-discrimination laws like we have now, but we need other theories. These old theories are essentially bankrupt for this new type of racism we have, where you see that what happens when the employer is forced to hire somebody black, and because the stereotype that attaches to West Indians is West Indians are hard workers and have many jobs, and they have to choose between a variety of people, they're going to choose the West Indian over, my kid. Maybe that's okay sometime, but maybe it's not. But we need to at least, tease it out. And the other thing is, we need to talk to each other, because, black Americans, I'm talking about the citizens of slaves, talk badly about Afro-Caribbean folks. Afro-Caribbean people talk badly about black folks. Afro-Latinos, we got some who don't even acknowledge that they're African roots. And others who don't want to be classified as black, who know that they, who would acknowledge it at home, but sort of secretly in most places, but who don't want to fall in that category because black people are victims of Katrina. And then the people who come from African countries, and also people who come from Europe, because we get black Brits and folks from Germany. We need to understand where they're coming from, because it doesn't take them long in this country to understand what I call all-purpose race. Okay, but there's no dialogue there. There's no dialogue between us, among us, to talk about the differences and how we can help each other in the way the law discriminates against us. And we can't look at each other as competitors. And that's the other bad thing that we tend to do.
Now, I was just gonna share, this morning when I walked in, the African security guard asked, can I ask you a question? He said, why is this conference called People of Color? it said, why don't you just say black people? Everyone who's come in has been a black person. And when you're like, well, if you were a colored person, how would you feel? And I said, well, that's different from a person of color. And he said, well, why does it matter? You're all black Americans. And I said, well, that's not necessarily true. And people of color is more inclusive to include in I think these different groups. And he said, do you really want to care about all the different groups? The bottom line is that you're black. And I'm down at the security. How we titled ourselves and how we saw ourselves. If we just wanted an explanation.
I don't really have answers. I'm just sort of, as I said, I'm trying to be provocative. They're these young, fresh minds. I mean, I'm just like, you know, I'm in my 60s decade now, so you know my brain is like slowing down. I'm just saying, you know, this is where I think we need to go. We need to stop massaging these old theories we have now. We need to start thinking outside the box. Kim.
As long as we're sharing. This is so timely. I want to, I guess, ask a question. Maybe just get some therapy about what happened. My race and law seminar on Wednesday, and I then brought it up with a buddy of mine and his two Ethiopian cousins last night. So I'll start with that just because it's in the crisis story. I was with three Ethiopians last night, and I was saying, you know, I had this discussion of race. We were talking about what does race mean, and I said, isn't there a commonality about being black, even if you have differences? Like, you're Ethiopian, might you not feel some solidarity with, like, Nigerian, at least if you're in this country? And they were like, no. And one of them said, in fact, when I check a box, it'll say race, it'll say white, black, Asian, Latino, Native American, other. And then they'll write in Ethiopian, which is sort of interesting. But anyway, the thing I was trying to get therapy from them for had to do with my race law seminar, we were discussing what is race. And I had everyone kind of give a bit of an introduction about their racial identity. And I explained that I'm an immigrant, and I came from Kenya. I was born in Uganda, and my father's Kenyan, my mother's British. And I grew up in basically a white neighborhood in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I said, I identify as black, although in some contexts I think of myself as biracial. But I said, I also feel I'm acculturated in white identity, or white culture, quote, meaning I just grew up in a white neighborhood and sort of mainstream dominant culture, I don't know what you want to call it, which is sort of what I'm kind of getting at. As you mentioned, say, Afro-British, Afro-Caribbean, is there an Afro-majority American black? So anyways, this other student put this, it's actually the president of BALSA, who is my second class, he and I had a great relationship. This other student asked him, he said, is Professor Fortman is really black? And he's like, don't give me an F on the first day. And then he asked him again, and he said, no. And I remember feeling jarred by it. I said, did you just say I'm not black? And he said, no, I thought that was in the matrix world. I just learned I'm not black. You defined it as you have to be like, identify with the descendants of slaves and identify with black culture. And so I wasn't sure if it was quite because I'm an immigrant or, but he since emailed me and apologized and said, well, you said you identify with white culture, so you can't be black. And in my mind, I think to myself, well, I was brought up in Birch Park, Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is a white neighborhood, but my dad's black, I was always told I was black, so I feel like I was raised to think about, I always thought of myself as black, which is a white kid. But we also, I didn't think of myself as culturally different. So the sort of distinction between race and culture, and whether you can be dominant in American culture, it's not even some foreign culture, but still be black.
I mean, we have been victimized by race, and we also victimize other people because of how race has been imposed on us. And you know, other than therapy, which I suggested we do need, we have a lot of work to do. I mean, and these are the kinds of stories, you know, that people, I mean, we have to talk about. I mean, you know, okay, I will talk about this. No, I was going to say, I mean, my story isn't quite the same, but oh, I guess a decade ago when I was teaching in Hawaii, I was teaching a critical race theory thing, and I said, had everybody go around the room and identify themselves. And so, you know, and people were saying, you know, so why? So, you know, it's like, you know, just like a all kinds of mixes of every sort of ethnic group you can think of. And there was a black woman there, only black woman in the school, as a matter of fact. She was very dark. And she said, I'm a black American. And so then it got to me. And so they said, well, what are you? And I said, well, I'm black. And they said, no, you aren't. What else are you? I'm saying, it's irrelevant what else I am in the U.S. I'm raised as black. And they said, it doesn't matter. He said, we here don't, you know, that's not how we look at race. And, you know, what else are you? Why are you denying the other parts of you? And, you know, it made me sort of think about, you know, how much we police ourselves and how it results in some positive stuff. But it results in a lot of heavy baggage that prevents us from moving ahead. And we have, that's deeply embedded in American race law, and we have to get rid of it. I mean, and I don't know how we, you know, I don't know how we do it. Aldina.
But to what degree is that racial solidarity based in the fact that for many of us, if you're asked the question, what else are you, we don't know the answer to that question. We can't say that. The one thing we know for sure is that there's this black. But if you don't know what the other pieces are, how do you incorporate that into your being?
I'll tell you a disclosure. I don't know if I've told many people. I've done two DNA stuff. The black guy used to be at Howard, has one that we can tell your African roots, and then there's another one. If you know anything about DNA and the genetic stuff, I mean, it's all somewhat suspect, especially if you realize how people move all over the world. But the one that I found most interesting was the one that says, based upon your genetic makeup, what portion of your makeup, at least from the maternal side, comes from this continent, that continent, that continent, which of course assumes a homogeneity on the continent. I mean, and there are all kinds of problematic stuff. I mean, the guy, they even had the Howard one, they even had a reunion of all the people. I didn't go. I was like too horrified. But people, I mean, but I did find some interesting stuff. I found actually the disclosure, the stuff from the Howard file to be the least satisfying. The one that I found most satisfying, most insightful for those of us who have these histories, is the one that talked about the so-called breakup, you know, where your makeup and the percentages, and because what it did was confirm what we always knew. We might not know exactly when or where it happened, but it does sort of open us to sort of think of ourselves as the real new people. I mean, you know, James Baldwin always talks about black Americans as the new people because we're a little bit of everything. And as more people come in, we become a little bit of everything. People raced as black, even who may phenotypically look white, have a much more complex DNA makeup than other folks. That's why, you know, our organs are such good organs for transplanting, because we are better matches. That's true for a wider variety of people. But I mean, I think that we have to come to grips with the fact that we may never know for sure where all parts of us come from. But that's true for most people, especially Europeans and people who come to this country who classify themselves as white. And we just have to accept this is our country. We made this country. This is an Afro-Anglo country. We are the new people who came out of all the miscegenation that occurred here. And this is our culture, and we've got to claim our co-authorship, or actually tri-authorship, because I don't want to denigrate indigenous people who were sort of Afro-Indian. But anyway, it's a multi-ethnic culture. I'm sorry. You get your hand up first. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that South Africa is actually onto something, right? Because in response to the cry of all.
you're colored, you're black, you're Asian, you know, the agency as a political identity, right? Everybody is black. But I like that because it suggests that there are multiple identities, right? So as a political identity, I can be black, but that in no way subverts the fact that culturally I might be Sunni or I might be lots of other things. It's an acknowledgement that this is an organizing tool, a political organizing tool. So, you know, I think that's something that may be helpful, you know, framing in terms of this is a political identity and nothing more than that.
But I'm telling you, affluent black Americans may not want that same political agenda that less affluent or socially aware people have, which they feel can really benefit all folks. They may not want to give up the bennies. So, I mean, I think we have to be very careful. We have to be very careful how we do this. I mean, I think it's hard to have anything that's unitary except the unitary goal to eliminate all forms of subordination, including race.
The point that's originally raising, which is like that the goal, an important part of this is to look at this issue of racial subordination and to fight against racial subordination and that presumably to fight white supremacy. I want to go back to the question that was asked back here about affirmative action. I mean, some of this is about the personal space, how we personally identify, but I mean, to me, that's a separate and actually, frankly, less important for my purposes mm-hmm. piece than the piece about how this plays out in terms of thinking about anti-discrimination law. If the affirmative action program at Harvard is an affirmative action program designed to promote diversity, which almost all of them are now, then I think your response to that question is quite accurate, that, you know, we benefit from having people who are Afro-Panamanian and people who are Afro-Peruvian and people who are from Ghana and people who are descendants of American slaves. But it's almost as though we just take it out of the conversation. The remedial purpose of affirmative action to address the history of slavery and Jim Crow and all of the results of that in the United States, and if that's the purpose of universities or any place's diversity plan, then it suggests to me that it does need to be targeted in a way that addresses that population, not to suggest that someone who's Afro-Caribbean doesn't also suffer the discrimination based on that same history, but that may be a way to think through how to tease it out.
Well, Sherilyn, I mean, actually, that was what I thought initially, because I actually started writing this piece, and I was focusing on the Harvard stuff and the education stuff, and said we have to have affirmative action that's remedial in nature, that's designed for the descendants of African slaves, and then we have to have this diversity piece. I get nervous for remediation, because why? Remediation is temporary. I don't want to let these folks off the hook, and I'm afraid that remediation, you know, will be... So we have to find something better. When I don't mind affirmative action, I mean, we have to find a better theory, a theory that will deal with, to remediate the need for a consistent and a long remediation, and that also does the diversity piece. We can't, I think that the terms diversity and affirmative action are so polluted that they can't be used. But we got to find a way to develop a theory that encompasses both of them and doesn't allow us to be co-opted with, you know, the O'Connor view of remediation being very short-term, as a temporary thing, which fails to acknowledge the continuing legacy and the of discrimination and the continuance of contemporary discrimination. So that's what I'm saying. It's hard. I mean, and that sort of, that might be a short-term route. I mean, and that's sort of where I am, but I don't even want to throw this out there for somebody to grab onto, because I think it ends up disadvantaging the folks who perhaps need a bit more help. But I mean, that's what I'm saying. We need to figure it out. I don't have the answers. And every time I start to go down one of these routes and use these new theories, I keep coming up with all these little ways the court has already made these limited.
The conversation this evening was, your response was, well, as long as those of us who get benefits from these divisions want to maintain those benefits, they're not, the efforts to make us uniform will be so rejected, or there will be some resistance to it, which I agree. But on the other hand, the idea that that we have this common goal of eliminating discrimination or subordination exists, those things seem to be in conflict with each other. It privileges that some of us in this the colored community will based on our position, will always want to have access to, but yet we are fighting for the dismantling of discrimination, those things. And it seems to me to mirror the kinds of conversations that took place within the feminist movement with women who weren't fighting for the dismantlement of hierarchies, but just to have the same access.
But that's why I'm saying I'm nervous about this notion of overall, because I'm a racial realist. American individualism runs very deep in this country, and since some of us have been in, our families have been in here a long time, we really believe it as much as many white Americans do. And so I think some of the real, some folks who are race something other than non-white really don't care about it. I mean, I would say Condoleezza Rice is well, I don't want to defame people. But I mean, I think there's some people who don't care as long as they get theirs, okay? Right. That's very American. And so you can't assume that people all want to go for this goal. And there's some who want to keep theirs and keep everybody out. They want to be, you know, the queen bee or the gatekeeper. And so, but they too could be stopped on the highway or followed in the store. Or stopped on the streets of, and so, and they may come together for that purpose, but not for the other. And so we have to, so this is hard work. I mean, I know this calls for real brainstorming and move and throwing everything out and starting anew. And it's not like a one-time battle, because every time you come up with a new theory, folks are going to come up with a way to undercut it. So it's, and we just need to use the 21st century as the impetus to move us forward and to try, and we need to really work much harder on forming coalitions and at least initiating the dialogue. And we have increasingly a community of color here. I mean, I remember, the old joke was when I did legal education in 1976, all of us could go to a restaurant and sit at the same table as AALS, and that was it, And now, this room won't hold everybody who is listed as non-white in the direction. So we have people even currently in the community who are ideologically all over the place, who have all kinds of multiple identities. And I mean, this is a good place to have these kinds of dialogues, because it's as safer space as you're going to find in the academic circus. And so I'm urging you, if nothing else, to instead of talking about all this, you all talk about nice little stuff, but I still think you need to have the works in progress. But I think you need to make what you're doing here much more, I hate this revolutionary word, but
revolutionary,
much more provocative, okay, to push people. You got some of the smartest people coming into legal academics these days, coming in as people of color, better credentials than, any of the people who came into legal education, black or white, when I was there in 1976. So you're going to use that brain power while you can. And then you're talking about cutting edge scholarship. And what we're doing is we're working in a very hostile environment. I always tell Sherilyn, I got depressed about how bad things are going. I started reading about what black intellectuals did after Plessy versus Ferguson. And said, how did people keep going? Because that's sort of how I felt, although it's not quite that bad. And so they kept thinking new theories. Bob Carter talks about being hired at the NAACP to think outside the box. We have become so comfortable in legal academia that we continue to think inside the box. How can I go and do this little bit? We gotta think outside the box. Think big, think broad, think radical. And I'm tired.